Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the Sound. It's Director of Public Affairs, John Vokette. Thanks for tuning into our award-winning public affairs program, For the People, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Well, the Connecticut Health Council recently created the Value-Based Relationship Workgroup. Their work is to identify new approaches to controlling the cost of health care and improving outcomes here in Connecticut. So we're going to check in with the co-chairs of this new initiative to learn about it and why they're still seeking additional stakeholders across the healthcare spectrum to be part of it. Then we're going to meet the director of the Connecticut Working Cities Challenge and a United Way representative to talk about the five cities across the state that have each received $350,000 grants to support cross-sector collaborative leadership and employment programs that will improve the lives of people in Hartford, East Hartford, Middletown, Danbury, and Waterbury. Then we're going to close replaying an important segment we did earlier this year with a Wells Fargo expert who's helping educate and protect Connecticut seniors from elder financial fraud. We're going to be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vokette, right after this reminder. Have you heard about Light Up the Point? Light Up the Point is happening at FTC in Fairfield, presented by TD Bank. This is a grassroots project looking to raise $30,000 or more this year for St. Vincent's Medical Center's Swim Across the Sound to honor Tom Liddy. This is a free event featuring the Alpaca Gnomes and the Alternate Routes that's happening on Saturday, August 25th from 4 to 10:30 p.m. They'll have food trucks, raffles, silent auctions, and a cash bar. And the best part is, you don't need a ticket. Just pop in when you can, check out some great music, have some food, maybe a beverage, and make a contribution. Want to learn more? Or maybe you can't make the event. Just check out the Light Up the Point at FTC page on Facebook, and you can make a contribution to the cause or get more details. Well, we know that a lot of folks are concerned about the cost of health care. And according to a recent survey conducted by Consumers for Quality Care, 85% of adult patients are concerned about their medical costs, despite the fact that they're insured. So in partnership with stakeholders across the healthcare spectrum, the Connecticut Health Council recently created the Value-Based Relationship Work Group to identify new approaches to controlling the cost of healthcare and improving outcomes. The group requires everyone involved to think creatively as a system while redesigning how and where care is delivered and paid for. We're really excited to have the work group co-chairs on the line with us this morning. Eric Galvin is with us. He's president of ConnecticutCare, and Jess Kupick is on the line, president and CEO of St. Francis Healthcare Partners. I want to thank you gentlemen both for joining us on the program this morning. And so we know healthcare is expensive here in Connecticut and costs continue to climb. But if I understand correctly, Connecticut sort of ranks in the middle and sort of toward the low end of the pack in terms of states in relation to healthcare costs. Do I have that right?
Yeah, John, it's Eric. You do. So depending upon the source that you look at, you'll see a range of Connecticut being the fifth or sixth most expensive down to the 17th most expensive in the country. And, we recognize that healthcare costs for everybody are a pain point, and that's one of the main reasons why, as Jess and I talked about day-to-day activity that we're involved with together, we said, you know, there's a better way to do this. There really is a much more affordable, a much better organized way to do this. So why don't we come together and figure that out? That was really the genesis behind trying to get this work group together.
And what role did the Connecticut Health Council play in all of this?
So interesting.
Yeah, hi, John. Yep. This is Jess.
Yes,
and, the Connecticut Health Council played a very important role in this. They actually convened all the stakeholders across the healthcare industry in Connecticut, and it was through that efforts in a program they put on last October actually last December, that we got together and decided it made more sense to have a broader approach to what we're doing. So they sponsor this work group. They help us with all the facilitation of the meeting and things of that nature. But they're a key partner in what we are trying to do. And so as Eric mentioned, when Eric and I got together representing the entities that we're responsible for and said there has to be a better way, we decided to expand it beyond just a relationship between ConnectiCare and St. Francis Healthcare Partners and really using the Connecticut Health Council as a vehicle to broaden it beyond a discussion between, you know, a provider and a payer.
Mm. So did the Health Council steer individuals representing the various stakeholders into the work group, or was that the sort of part of the function that they played, was getting the right people to the table, so to speak?
I would say they gave us the list of all those that have participated in other healthcare initiatives within the Connecticut Health Council, but it really was the group that Eric and I led inviting all who wanted to participate, and we had an overwhelming response to the very first meeting we had, which I think indicates the sensitivity and importance around what's going on in value-based care, and to your point before, the cost of healthcare in Connecticut being extremely high relative to the national average. So I think it was really, in a lot of ways, it was actually promoted by the group itself, but Connecticut Health Council provided us with the initial list that we went after.
Right. Well, can one or the other of you give folks listening an idea of the range of entities that are represented in the work group?
Yeah, absolutely, John. So the we have partners like St. Francis Healthcare Partners, ConnectiCare, but we have participants from really across the entire spectrum of the industry. So we have lab partners, we have radiology, other healthcare delivery systems, and what we're really looking for is representation from all of those different stakeholders so that we get the perspectives and we get the activities that we're going to be focusing on to lower cost and be much more coordinated across the care continuum. We want to get those solutions right. So we've even reached as far as thinking about the employer. And now, granted, we're all employers as we come together as companies within healthcare, but we also want to get perspectives of those outside of the healthcare continuum. And further, we have representatives from the state of Connecticut that have participated, really important stakeholders, whether they be regulatory or the Office of Healthcare Strategy. So we have a number of different units that have come together and have shared their thoughts. We're just looking for more and to try to pick up momentum with the work group.
Okay, so this is we're sort of in the early stages here at this point, right?
Yeah, we are, and as I said, we've had a number of discussions. We've tried to narrow the focus initially on an area where there's a significant need for better coordination of care, but also for types of patients that tend to have a lot of medical interactions, which are costly, and so we look at those opportunities to say, as Jess and I sit across from each other and we say, okay, what do you do to help manage these members? What do we do here at ConnectiCare? What do our lab partners do? What do other ancillary service providers do? How do we think about that in a much more, continuum of care rather than these components that are all siloed?
Well, did any or many of the stakeholders that are already at the table come on board with initiatives already in process to try to improve care at cost savings that that are now bringing that resource to the bigger work group?
Yeah, I think that everybody came with their own ideas, but the unfortunate part, it wasn't coordinated across the broader industry, so it was very siloed. We had a watershed moment in one of our meetings where one of the participants was relaying a story about a family member that had diabetes. And, you just envision a room with 25, 30 different stakeholders in it, and the subject of diabetes comes up. And so we ask the question, how many of you in this room would be, you know, part of the delivery system or part of the solution to someone who had diabetes? About three quarters of the hands came up. So we realized that everybody was doing something that they thought was the best to do, but it wasn't being coordinated.
And so if I understand correctly, diabetes now is sort of a pilot focus of the group?
Yes, that's where we started. And I think Eric referenced that, you know, we had to narrow it down and become more focused to be successful. And diabetes became an obvious choice based on that particular meeting, where it became obvious how many people were involved in trying to treat somebody with diabetes.
Mm-hmm. So is the focus on diabetes now going to work on collecting data from all of the stakeholders in terms of the various roles and places that they play in delivering services to individuals with type 2 diabetes?
Well, I just jump in to say the way that Jess and I have talked about it is, yes, data sharing and data collection, that's certainly important. But really, at the end of the day, there are so many overlapping activities. Everybody comes to the party, if you will, with the very best intentions of helping patients get the kinds of care that they need. And in doing so, they don't necessarily recognize that there may be a better setting for those types of touch points with the patient to happen. So, for instance, we might have nurses here at ConnectiCare that try to help diabetics manage the condition, but yet that may not be the best place for it. It may be, but we need to put those items out on the table and say, who's in the best place, who's best able to help that member in the way that they want to be helped. And at the end of the day, we're really trying to put the patient at the very center of each of these discussions so that we're doing the right thing for them collectively as an industry.
Very good. Well, I know from serving on various boards, there's always a need for particular expertise. You mentioned earlier, I think, Eric, that you were interested in perhaps bringing more employers to the table who are, kind of delivering healthcare to their workforce. What are some of the other individuals that you hope to attract to the work group in the future that you don't have now?
Yeah, so I would like to see, frankly, I'd like to see more healthcare insurers be at the table. If I think about the challenges from Jess's perspective and from the perspective of the hospital systems, they have many different health insurers that are, or the state, if it happens to be in the case of Medicaid, and they're having to deal with the demands and needs of all of those different entities that aren't standardized. I think it would also be helpful to have other hospital systems and other physician practices at the table. The more we're able to get, I don't want to say uniform because I think that's a lofty goal, but more consistency within some reason across the continuum, the better off the patient experience will be. Jess, are there others that you'd like to comment?
Yeah, I think we have representation for the majority of the stakeholder entities across the system, but we don't have enough, meaning we do have ConnectiCare there, but there's four or five other payers that should be at the table, and they're not. We have St. Francis at the table, but there's many more other hospital systems and delivery systems should be at the table, and they're not. So I think we have the right representation, just not enough of it to get a broad perspective, because it does vary payer by payer and delivery system by delivery system. So we have to broaden the group so that all the key stakeholders and all the representatives are there to get a broader perspective. So it isn't limited to just what does ConnectiCare think or St. Francis think, but what do payers in general think and what do delivery systems in general think?
Well, to kind of wrap things up for now, because this seems like an important project that we're going to need to be touching base with you folks on, in certain segments of time. But in the end, do you see this value-based relationship work group as something that is ongoing and open-ended, or is there some idea of reaching specific goals within a specific time frame?
You know, so I would just say this is, if we're successful, this is something that we should always be very busy on. How do we coordinate the next frontier and the next frontier? We are trying to really nail down the right measurements of success, if you would, around the diabetes pilot that we're looking to put together. We have a work group meeting on Monday, September 10th, and I'd love to invite your listeners, if there are people that are a part of this continuum, employers, other health plans, other delivery systems, that they really should reach out to Amy Cunningham at the Metro Hartford Alliance. And you know, I think we also would say that while we've chosen diabetes to get specific and very tactical, that's only one of many conditions and many types of interactions that patients have that that we as an industry have an opportunity to do a much better job with.
And is the work that you're doing, is it borrowed from or inspired by similar work being done in other states, other regions, or even elsewhere on the globe? Or is this sort of a first of its kind thing that just kind of organically came together over the recent months?
From my perspective, it's not being done in Connecticut. I think its origins were very organic. That really came out of a conversation that Eric and I were having. I don't know, Eric, if you have any insights as to whether or not we have success stories in other parts of the country, but certainly within the state of Connecticut, it's the first.
Yeah, the only thing I'd add there is that there are other states or regions that may be considered to be, quote, more progressive in terms of value-based relationships, but the reality is that they're very difficult things to pull off. And so what we try to do is look at some of the other areas of the country, like Texas or California, where you have much tighter integration of providers and payers, for instance, and use those lessons to inform the work, but really not dictate the way that we're going about doing it. We really, as Jeff said, it's really an organically grown effort because Connecticut is unique in some of its characteristics. We didn't want it to feel like we were forcing another model that may not be successful here.
Very good. Well, if anyone's listening and they're engaged with any health plans, hospitals, doctors, pharmaceutical companies, if they're consumer advocates or insurance brokers, the work group is interested in hearing from you. You can get with Amy Cunningham, who's with the Connecticut Health Council, at 860-728-2298. Maybe make plans to be at the next work group meeting, which is Monday, September 10th at 9 a.m., we hope that they will be there for you, gentlemen, and we hope that the program helps facilitate in some way some good results in terms of the work that you're doing. In partnership with stakeholders already involved across the healthcare spectrum, the Connecticut Healthcare Council recently created the Value-Based Relationship Workgroup to identify new approaches to controlling the costs of healthcare and improving outcomes. Workgroup co-chairs Eric Galvin, president of Connecticut, and Jess Kupick, president and CEO of St. Francis Healthcare, are with us on the line this morning. I want to thank you, gentlemen, for teaching us about this important work that you're doing, and we look forward to talking with you both and other stakeholders again about the great work that this group is endeavoring to do here on behalf of all the folks who need healthcare delivered to them and their families here in Connecticut. So thank you very much. Well, a couple of weeks ago here in Connecticut, actually on August 8th, virtually a few days ago, there was a breakfast held in Hartford that was involving how cross-sector collaboration helps communities thrive. And this is tied to the Working Cities Challenge, which is a grant competition designed by the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston to support cross-sector collaborative leadership and ambitious work to help improve the lives of people in small and mid-sized cities. Hartford and East Hartford were among the five cities in the state to receive the grant, along with Middletown, Danbury, and Waterbury. And we're pleased to welcome to the program for the first half of our conversation, David Radcliffe. He's director of Connecticut Working Cities Challenge. David, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So give us the quick background on this. It's sort of a Federal Reserve vehicle, but there's a lot of other partners that are involved in putting the funding together, right?
That's right, and it might be helpful for your listeners to know that the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston is part of the central bank for the United States. We're one of 12 districts in the country, and we cover all of the New England states, minus Fairfield County, and our work as a system and as a district branch is to help with the vitality and health of the U.S. economy. No small thing, and primarily folks may know of the Federal Reserve System's work through some research, but also monetary policy in terms of setting interest rates. And the Boston Fed, along with the other sister branches in the country, also have a community development function. And the Boston Fed did some research a few years ago to try to understand what caused so many of our smaller cities who were thriving 50 years ago to struggle so mightily. And yet found through this research that there was a subset that were able to turn around and for the betterment of the lower-income and middle-income folks in these communities. And that research led us to create the Working Cities Challenge, which identified, as you mentioned in the opening, the cross-sector collaborative leadership. And by that, we mean the key senior leaders from the public sector, so city and state government, from the private sector, neighborhood residents, and also nonprofit leaders to work together around a shared goal to, again, improve the economic well-being of these communities. And the Connecticut Working Cities is the fourth round of the competition. There are two rounds in Massachusetts, Rhode Island, a year or so ago, and then Connecticut started off earlier this year. And as you mentioned, the five Connecticut cities, after a year of planning, were awarded by an independent selection jury $450,000 grants to do 3 years of work to tackle some of these challenging local economic issues.
And that's $450,000 per community.
Per community, right.
Yeah, so that's pretty exciting. That's a good chunk of change.
I just mentioned the resources come not directly from the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston, although we provide staffing, coaching, and other supports, but it's from a collaboration of cross-sector funding partners, including the state of Connecticut, some national philanthropy, and Connecticut funders, including private sector and other philanthropy.
There's about a little over a dozen qualifying cities in Connecticut, of which five captured awards this year. So it's, I guess, kind of a banner year for this program here in Connecticut. So congratulations to you on that. But tell us a little bit about how, the qualifying standards.
Sure. So there were 16 cities in Connecticut that were identified as meeting the eligibility criteria, which included population and poverty and family income measures. And those 16 cities all applied for a planning grant, and 10 of those were awarded last year. Mm. And for those 10 communities, there were 7 months of planning. And that planning was organized around what we consider the four key ingredients for cities to have success in this space. And again, it includes cross-sector collaborative leadership, community engagement, and also systems change, and also learning orientation. So within those four categories, these communities built their teams and their plans and applied for the full implementation grants, again, of five of which were awarded earlier this year.
So we're going to be talking with Maura Cook from United Way of Central and Northeastern Connecticut in the second half of our conversation, and she's going to be keying in on the grants that her United Way was working on, which is Hartford and East Hartford. But can you tell us a little bit about what Middletown, Danbury, and Waterbury are utilizing their grants for, and how they plan to target the qualifying work that needs to be done?
Sure. So one thing that's really interesting and exciting about the Connecticut cities, all five of them are, these, again, were thriving communities back in the day and, in many cases have hit hard times, but also have quite a few significant resources and assets, including folks who are really wanting to roll up their sleeves and sort of change how business gets done, and for the betterment of the folks who live there. And this was less so in the Rhode Island and Massachusetts rounds of working cities, but in Connecticut, all five cities identified employment and workforce issues as sort of the goal that they each of their teams identified and shared as they want to do something about. So it's a bit different in how each city approaches it, but generally wanting to reduce unemployment and to lift incomes, and to do that with a variety of strategies that, really the idea is to build on what's existing and some of the existing activities and work and collaborative activity rather than constructing something new, but to also, for these cities to look in creative ways at how their systems, employment systems in particular, are working, and in some cases not as effective as they could be, and try to cause them to behave in better, more sustainable ways. So, again, these cities each have their own character and history and personality, but generally they're all very interested in and trying to improve economic and employment prospects for their local residents.
Okay. Were the specifics of how they were going to utilize the funds, if awarded, part of the grant application, or are these applications a little bit more general, and once they get the grant, then they need to report on how they're applying it?
Right. So, what each city identified as what they wanted to work on is really up to them. So it was not the Boston Fed or our partner saying you need to do this, except that had to be within the broad framework of economic growth. And so each city constructed a plan based on what they thought would be most impactful locally. And summaries of those plans are available at the Boston Fed's Working Cities website. So if you want to get a bit of a snapshot as to what each city is doing and how they're approaching it, and that might be a good place for your listeners to check out. And, the cities were awarded these grants, based on a very detailed action plan that was put together. And, it met a certain criteria that our independent selection jury looked at. So it was merit-based competition based on those four criteria I mentioned earlier. And, these cities, in terms of their plan and an interview that was part of the selection process, you really put forward compelling narratives and also action plans that folks felt were worthy of investing in terms of this additional resource to help them do this work.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, before we hang up with you and take a quick break and then pick it up with Maura Cook, where do you go from here, David? And where does the Connecticut Working Cities Challenge go from here, and now that these five cities are working on implementing the grants that they've already received?
Yeah, so this is an exciting part of the journey. So, these cities were involved, over a past year and a half in doing lots of planning, and now with this award are able to actually get down to business. And in my work as director of Working Cities in Connecticut, I'm a longtime Connecticut resident, have been here my whole adult life, so I'll work closely with these five teams and provide some coaching and support, and we also construct some learning opportunities, based on what teams identified, what we might see as additional supports that would help them be super successful. So over these next 3 years, that's what we'll be doing, is working closely with these cities to help them be successful as they can for their lower-income neighbors and particularly also communities of color. There's significant poverty in our cities in particular, and it's often segregated by race, and we want teams to think and do carefully in that space as well.
Excellent. Well, we really appreciate you taking some time to kind of talk with us about this event that went down on August 8th and all the excitement that's going on now in Connecticut in terms of boosting members of the workforce who may not be employed or have sustainable employment. Great work on your part, and we look forward to keying in on a couple of the cities that are being aided here in Connecticut, two of the five cities to win Connecticut Working Cities Challenge grants. David Ratcliffe is the director of the Connecticut Working Cities Challenge, and we'll be back and talk with Maura Cook at the United Way of Central and Eastern Connecticut right after the break. David, for now, we'll bid you adieu. Thank you so much for your time. Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through Love CT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click on to Love CT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. Did you know that $3 or so that you spend for your morning mug of coffee or tea or other beverages can provide $81 of medical care to a suffering child right here in Connecticut? Healing the Children Northeast is asking you to donate your morning beverage money for only one day or maybe a week. How about a month or more? Just a few dollars from a lot of people will make all the difference to children who need your help. You can learn more about the agency's Match My Mug campaign and the good work being done on behalf of Connecticut's kids facing health challenges by visiting Healing the Children Northeast at htcne.org. We also want to remind music lovers that on Saturday, September 8th from 11 to 10, it's the Connecticut Folk Fest and Green Expo and their annual free festival of live music, handmade artisans, food trucks, children's activities, and green workshops at New Haven's Edgerton Park. Besides a ton of great music, including headliner Martin Sexton, the Green Expo highlights over 50 exhibitors that include handmade artisan ware, exhibitors with innovative ideas and products for sustainable lifestyles, as well as New Haven's finest food trucks. Proceeds benefit Connecticut Folk's mission to educate, entertain, and inspire a diverse audience through music and conversation to create a socially responsible and environmentally sustainable community. Want more information? Just visit ctfolk.org. All right. Well, as promised, we have switched gears and we're now on the line with Maura Cook. She's the Director of Community Engagement and Marketing for United Way of Central and Northeastern Connecticut. Maura, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So we heard a little bit from David already about some of the grants that were awarded and mention of United Way's role in helping all of the communities in Connecticut that achieved these grants. But let's talk specifically about yours, because if I understand correctly, this is something you've been working on for about or a little over a year. And this all kind of came together around a breakfast that actually has been happening every year for a long time.
Yes. So we had a lot to celebrate this year at our annual breakfast, which we host in partnership with Metro Hartford Alliance. And at our United Way, it's really our mission to bring people together across sectors and across geography to collaborate on programs and initiatives that are going to get real results for children and families. And for years, we've been a leader in really developing and launching integrated programs that are meeting the holistic needs of people. Working Cities and the Challenge Grant is really one way that we've done this recently. And as you mentioned, we've been working with our teams in Hartford and East Hartford for over a year, going through the planning process, working with design teams to think about what could we do that would bring systemic change in Hartford and East Hartford for families and to create a thriving city and community. The Working Cities Challenge is really about encouraging leaders from the public and private and nonprofit sectors to tackle these complex challenges that are facing our smaller cities so that we can work together to achieve a large-scale impact. And there are already a lot of high-quality programs and initiatives in both Hartford and East Hartford that are focused on getting jobs for people that also meet employers' needs, which is a really important part of the equation here for us. So we often hear from employers that they don't have enough job applicants who have the skills to fill their open positions, particularly in the areas of manufacturing and healthcare. And we know that there are people in our communities who are looking for these jobs, but they may not be aware of the services or training opportunities that are available for them to secure those jobs. So part of our work with the Working Cities Challenge, particularly in Hartford, is to raise awareness among young adults who are ages about 16 to 29, because we know that this population in Hartford is unemployed at higher rates than their peers in the region and statewide. And so our goal is to raise awareness among employers about how they can tap into the talent that we have here in Hartford among young adults. And in East Hartford, we are working with a particular neighborhood, and it's the neighborhood that is surrounding the Silver Lane school, and really looking to do something similar in terms of creating awareness and access of jobs that are available and working with employers to create strategic pipelines to help people get and retain those jobs.
So how does the application of these are $450,000 per community?
Mm-hmm.
So I guess first of all, the question is, are there crossover points that can really maximize the total of $900,000 that flowed into this, you know, somewhat tight strategic area, although one of the grants is targeted at a specific neighborhood while the other is a community-wide application. Are you finding that either the employers that you're targeting for the to give them the information and the resources the same, or you know, where's the crossover here, if any?
Absolutely, and I think that's a really important point that you raise in terms of why it's so valuable to have United Way at the table, not just in Hartford and East Hartford, but in all of the cities that have been awarded in our states. We are an organization who regularly is working to bring people together across sectors and talk about the issues that matter most. And so we are certainly able to, in Hartford and East Hartford, share resources and ideas and connections that can create meaningful opportunities for the people and the residents in those cities. So we are absolutely working together and at the table actively. While we're leading the team in Hartford, we're still at the table in East Hartford and sharing those connections and sharing those ideas so that we can create a really robust strategy that helps people get jobs here in Hartford and East Hartford. And I think that these models are something that we hope can help more and more people get jobs in our state.
Mm-hmm. And going into the grant, what was the process through which you qualified this specific East Hartford neighborhood versus the entire community or another neighborhood in that city?
Yeah, so actually in both cases we are zeroing in some specific neighborhoods and areas, and that's because we know that if we can go deep in a specific area of the city, we can create systems that could be replicable for other areas. And I think that's really the idea, is, you know, starting with an area and going deep so that you can create wider systemic change. And I think that in both cases, the design team spent a lot of time looking at data for the cities that they were applying on behalf of. And we also, United Way took the lead in both areas in holding community conversations with residents in those neighborhoods. And we heard a lot about how they felt about the current state and what their aspirations were for their city and their community. And it was really about having access to education, to jobs, to experience, particularly for the young adults, knowing that they needed experience to be able to get the types of jobs that they wanted and that would allow them to make more than ends meet, but really not knowing how to go about getting that experience and not feeling that they necessarily had the opportunity. And so how can we bring the voices of those residents and those employers together, and employers feeling like they needed to do more to let people know they're here and they have job openings and they need qualified folks to fill them. So I think that there's so much potential here. A key part of the design and implementation was really about finding out what is standing in the way of connecting people to complete these programs so that they can enter into the workforce. And so now part two is, you know, we've heard from people and we've heard from a lot of people and across sectors. And so I think the second part of this work is to look at the workforce education system, to speak with employers through some of the partnerships we already have in both communities, and bring those folks together. And then our other goal, particularly in Hartford, is to involve young adults in shaping the solutions to the challenges that we've identified. So we're going to be starting a young adult leadership group.
Oh, that's great.
And that group is going to learn about, we're so excited about it because, especially in the community conversations, they had a lot to say and they had a lot of ideas about how things could be different and identifying the barriers that are really standing in the way. So that group is going to learn about leadership and civic engagement skills while helping their peers to get on those pathways towards successful careers.
Well, before we let you go, let's flip over to the side of the employers. We hear so much on this program about specific sectors, particularly manufacturing and advanced manufacturing, where there's 2,000, 3,000 open available jobs every day in Connecticut with significant payroll benefits, significant health and retirement benefit packages for individuals who come into these jobs. How much are you hearing back so far from the employers you're reaching out to, or are you working on pitching these employers to not just give jobs, but to give the training that it takes for people to successfully move into and sustain employment in these jobs?
Sure. So for several years, our United Way has been a leader for something that's called the Workforce Solutions Collaborative of Metro Hartford. And that group is a funders collaborative that focuses on, just what you asked me about, which is working with employers to find out what their needs are and creating the programs and the training and the access to have folks who need jobs be ready to step into those programs. And particularly in East Hartford, that's something that Workforce Solutions has been working closely with the Working Cities Group on in terms of connecting folks to jobs at Pratt & Whitney. And so at the breakfast, we heard from Chris Smith, who's a senior director in human resources, because they have a program right now that is a training program. They have folks from East Hartford who are training have full-time employment at Pratt & Whitney. And so far, both our intermediaries and our partners who are supporting the future employees as they go through the program and Pratt & Whitney are thrilled with the progress. And it's a really interesting model that is just in its first cohort. Mm. We're excited to see what more we can do. And there are certainly other employers who have been doing this with Workforce Solutions over the years, particularly in the areas of manufacturing, but also in healthcare. We really are excited about this work. We think it's something that United Way can continue to support growing. It's a part of our targets and our goals for the coming year that we successfully help 650 people get jobs this year. And so we need the support of the community to continue to help us do that and achieve those goals.
Fantastic. Maura Cook is Director of Community Engagement and Marketing for United Way of Central and Northeastern Connecticut, co-sponsoring a recent event that happened in the Hartford area, a breakfast with the theme, How Cross-Sector Collaboration Helps Our Communities Thrive. We're hearing a lot about that now, thanks to the 5 Working Cities Challenge Grants that were awarded across Connecticut, more specifically involved in work being done in Hartford and East Hartford. We want to thank you, Maura, for being on the show, as well as David Ratcliffe, who was with us earlier in the program. And we'll certainly touch base with you again as we get down the road a little bit to hear more about what I anticipate is going to be great success and hopefully connecting some of the folks who really want and need good jobs to the training and employment that the industries in Connecticut are calling for. So thanks for your great work, and we'll talk to you again probably in about 6 to 8 months. Well, as promised, we're going to wrap up our program with a very important subject. Elder financial abuse spans a broad spectrum of predatory behavior like forging checks, misusing power of attorney, exploiting loneliness, or scamming and deceiving individuals by using scare tactics or exaggerated claims to get money. This is an issue we're hearing about and reading about in the headlines right here in Connecticut all too frequently, and we are so pleased to bring in a national expert on this issue. Ron Long is with us on the line today. He's a senior vice president and director of regulatory affairs and elder client initiatives for Wells Fargo Advisors. Ron, thanks for joining us on the program.
Mr. Vauquette, thanks for having me.
Very good. Call me John, and I'll call you Ron, and we'll sound nice and friendly for the folks that are listening, because this is a really, really important subject. So important, in fact, that Wells Fargo initiated and funded a study about elder financial abuse, right?
Exactly. We were concerned with the rate of elder financial abuse, where we see one in five seniors, 65 and older, being subject to abuse. Estimates are close to $36 billion are lost every year, but I say that number, this is not just a rich person's crime. That bad guys are out there trying to get money from our seniors. Whatever amount they have, they're looking for ways to take it from them.
Yeah, I get the impression that they cast a wide net, and they're quite effective at putting those smaller amounts together, obviously, to add up to a massive number, which you know, could affect a small country if taken in aggregate. But for so many of these people who are the victims, this literally is the reservoir, the remaining reservoir of their life savings.
That is exactly right. You have folks who've done the right things. They planned for a long, healthy, prosperous life, and all of a sudden, a bad guy comes in, takes substantial money from them, and cuts that potential and that hope off.
So I'm learning from the advance that you sent that it may be these days, for some reason, you know, it's easier to talk about taking away a driver's license or thinking about transitioning an elder loved one into some sort of care situation or assisted living than it is to have the conversation about protecting themselves from financial fraud. That is very intriguing to me.
No, it is amazing, particularly where you see in the survey show that 80% of the adult children of older Americans want their parents to plan, but they just aren't seeing an urgency to having the conversation. And 35% of the older adults don't seem to want to do the planning now because they think it interferes with them enjoying life today.
And we're talking about almost 16 out of every 100 Connecticut residents falling into this age category.
Yeah, Connecticut is going up into one of the older states. A lot of folks like the state and they stay there. So that it puts them in a position to be vulnerable. And when the adults and their adult children, many of whom have moved away or what have you, don't have these conversations, you're simply not allowing your parents to put in place the planning documents we think that could make it less likely they would become victims of fraud.
Mm. And as we heard from an earlier guest who was talking with us about the AARP Fraud Watch seminars, which is a great companion to the work that you folks are doing at Wells Fargo, many of these people are from a generation that had trust when people called them on the phone or they got a letter or someone knocked on the door. They had a trust for authority and they had confidence that they would not be a victim of that individual. And your study has a very, very disturbing disparity between the way folks of that older generation, 60, 65 and older, think that they're susceptible to fraud versus how worried their kids or their loved ones or their caregivers of a younger generation are worried that they could fall victim to these unscrupulous individuals.
No, that's exactly right. Often when we get a story of a victim, you hear them say, I never thought I would be victimized or would fall for such a scam. And 1 in 10 of our older Americans don't think they'll be susceptible. But both they and their children, almost 100%, believe that as you age, you do become susceptible. So we have a disconnect there that we need the adults and their adult children having these conversations to help fight through that disconnect.
And there's also a disconnect, I guess, between who the elder people think will be victimizing them.
No, that one is also disturbing. 66% of the elder think it's a stranger, my friend, the Nigerian prince, or some other type person, where the facts are 66% of the abuse of elders comes from family, friends, or other trusted individuals, such as religious leaders, attorneys, what have you.
Well, that being said, let's turn to some of the ideas and advice that you have, Ron Long, to give to folks. The most challenging one is that interesting and sometimes very troubling dynamic between younger siblings or nieces, nephews, cousins, who the point people are, who are in charge of kind of keeping an eye on, or in some cases, providing complete 24-hour care for their aging loved ones, how to figure out and determine whether or not, heaven forbid, one of these caregivers is actually the one who is victimizing the elderly person, and how the others can potentially assist in the matter.
No, I think an assist is exactly the word. We want folks to plan, and it can be. And we did see from our stats that older Americans say that half of them know at least one family member they don't want managing their funds. So we think if we have the full family conversation, make the choice of who's in charge, who will help, but then maybe have another set of eyes where somebody gets a duplicate bank statement or account statement so they can simply review things once a month to make sure everything looks kosher. So you have the on-scene caregiver, but then you have somebody else taking a second look.
Now, would you advise that an attorney or someone who has some degree of expertise in elder financial management be brought into the picture here to oversee this kind of split in the oversight on behalf of the senior?
Well, every family is different, but for the right family, a third party such as an attorney, sometimes it could be the accountant or it could be a financial professional, but we do think that third party allows the family to come together, talk about the issues in a rational way, and then work out a plan that they all believe in and is workable after they put it together.
Well, with one in five Americans over the age of 65 falling victims to financial abuse, and we read about them, I'm sorry to say, here in Connecticut, it seems like around once a week or so, we see a news article or a report or a headline of somebody victimizing a senior. Sometimes it's a family member. Sometimes it's a caregiver, a nurse, an aide, what have you. Sometimes it's actually the financial advisor or the perceived trusted advisor, which makes it kind of rough to know who to trust, especially as we said earlier, when you have a situation where only 10% of the seniors don't trust anybody, and almost 100% of the caregivers are worried that their loved one is going to fall victim. What are some other ways that you and the folks at Wells Fargo advise folks to position themselves to at least minimize the risk of their senior loved one falling victim to financial fraud?
So it is some of these basic planning behaviors. So you're having the conversation where you let folks know where the financial documents are, the key passwords. You have the end-of-life documents, whether it's a will or trust. You have a health care directive. And you have conversations about financial matters so that there isn't secrets. It's not a secretive process, so that you're using the sunlight, transparency, so that everyone knows what the plan is, how it should work, and they can quickly see when something's not going right with the plan.
So in the last 3 minutes or so that we have with you, Ron, what are a few of the things that the loved ones, the children or the caregivers should either be looking for themselves in the financial paperwork or sitting down with their senior loved one or the person they're caring for, and actually get a pen and paper out and maybe the magnifying glass and taking a look at some of this fine print? Where can we see that things may be going wrong?
That's a great idea. So you can look at some of the basic documents you have, and whether it's from the financial professional or the accountant, and get the second look from someone else. So if it's financial professional, maybe you have the accountant. If it's a lawyer, maybe you have the financial professional, something like that, where everybody is using some sort of redundancy to just make sure things are in place. And you also want, many of us don't live with our older parents, so when you visit the house, you want to have your eyes open for different signs, whether it's unpaid bills or the house is more unkempt than it used to be. All of these could be indications of potential abuse or maybe a dementia or decline, which is also a problem we have to address that leads to some of the abuse that elders face.
Very good. So I understand Wells Fargo has a an internet resource available for folks who are caregivers who want to not only get refreshed on some of the advice that you gave today, but also get a lot of the additional information that came out of this Wells Fargo study. What's the website that they can go to learn more?
Sure. They can go to WFA.com, and on that website we'll have a guide. It's called the Elder Financial Abuse Protection Guide, and it works both for the seniors and the children who work with the seniors. So either or could initiate these conversations, talk about putting the family plan in place, and then sitting back and relaxing as you work the plan and let the senior enjoy the long and prosperous life that they've put together for themselves.
Very good. Elder financial abuse spans a broad spectrum of predatory behavior, and 14% of elders were fraud victims just in the past year. And the most disturbing thing is only 2% of these abuse situations are reported. So making this form of abuse is really a silent crime. So we hope you'll visit the Wells Fargo resources for more information. And we want to thank our guest again this morning, Ron Long. He's a senior vice president and director of regulatory affairs and elder client initiatives for Wells Fargo Advisors for filling us in and getting this whole plan started. Ron, I dare say you've probably started a lot of folks here on Mother's Day with an idea of how they might want to spend more time with their mothers and their fathers and taking even better care of them. So thank you so much for closing out our Mother's Day show with this very important advice, and we appreciate talking with you. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a PSA relevant to the audience and communities we serve, you must make a request for airtime in writing to me via email at john.voket, that's john.voket, at connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast without permission of Connoisseur Media. Our public file, reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve, can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scotts, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again at this time next week for more conversation and important information on the award-winning For the People. Don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Eastern and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring. Right.